What makes a city holy? Why are Hebron, Tiberias, Sfat, Jerusalem holy cities according to the tradition? Haifa, Jaffa, Caesarea, Nablus not. Holiness is, of course, in the eyes of the beholder. And the best way, I think, to make this point clear is to read you an article I clipped almost 20 years ago, which was describing an interview with a man named Zev Vilnai, who was one of the classic guides to Israel in the 40s and 50s, a man who's compiled a number of volumes on the legends of Palestine, an encyclopedia in Eretz Yisrael. The year that he received the Israel Prize for his work in recording the legends and the history of Israel, he told this story to one of the reporters. In the late 1920s, while taking a group of young people on a visit to historic spots, during which he recounted many of the tales he had gathered from historic sources, they came upon a huge rock, nearly 7 feet high, on a hilltop near Hartuv in the mountains of Judea. Vilna was in an expansive mood, and on the spur of the moment, he gathered his young charges around the rock and improvised the following legend. When the Romans prepared to besiege Jerusalem, the leaders of the garrison sent a message to every Jew in all the surrounding towns and villages, asking each to bring a large stone with which to strengthen the fortifications of the city and the temple. In those days, there lived in the village of Tzora a mighty man descended from Samson. His spirit rose up in him, and the strength of his ancestors flowed in his veins. And this man tore a massive boulder from the side of the mountain, heaved it up on his shoulders, and began to walk towards the holy city. He was still on the mountain pathway when he beheld thick pillars of smoke rising from the hills to the east. He realized that he was too late. The city had been taken, and the temple had been destroyed. He stumbled, and he fell in tears. His strength ebbed away, and the mighty stone pressed him down and crushed him to death under its weight. Here he found his grave. Since then until this day, the massive rock has been known as the Rock of Destruction, in memory of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Vilni was pleased with his story and included it in the next edition of his Legends of Palestine, prefacing the account only with, quote, "of this rock the following legend is told," unquote. Technically, he was correct. The legend was repeated in subsequent editions, plagiarized, adapted, republished, and quickly became a classic handed down through the centuries. There are two epilogues to this story. The first happened many years later when Vilna escorted another group of visitors on a tour of Judean historic places, and they insisted that he take them to the Rock of Destruction. He did so, but as they approached, a Yemenite Jew who had been standing alongside the monument came up to Vilna and courteously suggested that the veteran guide cover his head. "This is a holy spot," the Yemenite said, and kissed the stone fervently. "How could I tell him," Vilni asked, "that if he had venerated the story, it was rather me he should kiss?" The second occurrence was when the Israel Ministry of Religion, anxious to preserve the identity of holy spots, which might be lost and forgotten, held a formal ceremony dedicating the Rock of Destruction and erecting a plaque marking it as an official holy shrine. Vilni was not invited. Holiness is that sense of a special power. In our Western tradition, we would say the presence and power of God, emanating from a particular object or place or act or even a human being. The Latin word sanctus is a direct translation of the Hebrew kadosh, holy. And a place where worship is called a sanctuary, a holy place. The act and the ritual give off that sense somehow of the presence and the power of God. I don't know if you've noticed in the names of some synagogues, particularly synagogues in Europe, but they'll have either a kuf kuf or a KK in front of the name, Kehila Kedosha, which means a holy congregation. Now, our response to holiness may be spontaneous. When Isaiah was in the temple in Jerusalem, and had a sense of the presence of God, he blurted out, Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzvaot, Melocha La'aretz Kvodo, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory, the words we still use in our worship service. Or it may be a sense which we have choreographed into worship, as when a congregation rises whenever the Torah is taken out of the ark, and rises again in respect when it is returned to the ark. All of this is the feeling that we capture in the legend of the burning bush. When Moses hears God speak out of the bush and is told, take off your sandals from off of your feet, for this is Admat Kodesh, for this is holy ground. The temple in Jerusalem was called Beit HaMikdash, the holy house. And there's a whole collection in the Talmud, which deals with the instruments and the vessels and the rituals and the sacrifices in the temple, which is called kodashim, materials dealing with holy objects and holy utensils. And the greatest act of loyalty by which a Jew proves his faith is called kiddush Hashem, martyrdom, being holy ultimately in the faith of God. Now, the word kadosh, this adjective, holy, comes from an old Akkadian root, kadasu, which means to be bright, to shine. Almost every emotion has some kind of physical quality associated with it in people's minds. We're creatures of the senses. And the sense of luminescence, of charisma, if it's in the sense of, in one sense, is that which we associate with holiness. When Moses comes down from the mountain, having been with God, receiving the commandments, his face is alight with keren or, with rays of light, the sense of the holy, from having been in the presence of God. And when we, artists over the centuries, pictured the saints, the holy men, they put a nimbus, they put a halo around them, this external symbol to identify their holiness and their power. And one who is holy has power, and those who have power are both useful to mankind and a danger. We have to keep our distance from the generator. And so Moses, when he comes down from the mountain, no longer lives within the encampment. He is set aside. He now lives as a holy man outside the camp in a tent set apart. And that's generally true, by the way, of shamans and holy men in African and Indian tribes. We need their power at moments of worship, at moments of when we need to plead with the elements, with God, the gods, but otherwise we want to keep them at a distance, fearful of the power that they represent. Now, that which is holy, unlike radium, some mineral which keeps giving off energy, is holy because we invest our own feelings, our own sense of power into it. And we have a feeling that any failure to relate to that which is holy in the proper way might be a cause of danger to us. And just as those who operate the nuclear power plants are very careful of the procedures that they use, so those priests who entered the Holy of Holies in the Temple of Jerusalem did so with fear and trepidation. Indeed, in the Second Temple days, only the high priest, once a year, was allowed to enter the temple. And then only after, for several nights before, other priests had instructed him in the exact steps that he should take, the genuflections he should make, the confession, the words of the confession that he should speak, and the acts that he should perform there. For if he made a single mistake, it might be a fatal mistake for him. And the Bible contains the myth which describes the sense of the power we sort of instinctively ascribe to holy things. And it describes the wars between the Philistines and the Israelites before the King David appears in the late 11th century. And at one point during these wars, the Philistines capture the Holy Ark, and they take it to their capital. And there the Holy Ark causes such confusion, such destruction among the Philistines, that they send an emissary to the Hebrews demanding that the Holy Ark be taken back. They can't handle its wild, destructive, in this case, energy. Holiness, then, is a natural response of awe, of reverence, fear, to an object which has been associated somehow with the presence and the power of God. It is therefore not necessarily a response which is to man's benefit. It does not necessarily mean that because we are in the presence of that which is seems to us holy, we will be blessed by that presence. A false prophet exuded the same sense of awe, of reverence, of holiness as a true prophet. And the Hasidic Rebbe, who was the presence of holiness in the Hasidic circles of Europe, often was able to work through the problems of his people. Quite often he was likely to tell some of his people that he could cure their ailments when indeed they should have been sent to a physician. Holiness then is neither beneficial nor harmful, neither good nor bad, but simply a natural instinctive response which even we in our cynical and secular age can sometimes have. I remember those who went to Jerusalem right after the 67 war, when for the first time it was possible to visit the Western Wall. And many went puzzled by all this shtush that people were making about visits to the wall. What could it possibly mean? It was nothing but a wall. And one by one, they would come back and tell me that it had been one of the most moving and powerful spiritual experiences of their lives. It has spoken to them, I suppose, of Israel's past. For the first time, they had sensed something of the holiness of Jerusalem, of the temple. It was a sign, I suppose, in a more immediate way of the renewal of Jewish life in our times. Whatever it was, the vibrations that were given up were powerful ones, powerful enough to move people like us who are not naturally caught up in the holiness of rocks, the holiness of graveyards, the holiness of amulets, holiness of many of those objects which preoccupied the minds and the concerns of our fathers. And because holiness is such a basic, instinctive, but neutral emotion, sensible and wise religious leaders have always tried to fill the vessel, the word holy, with something more than awe, something more than fear, something more than this instinctive emotional reaction, to give it meaningful content. And interestingly, when we deal with the holiness of Jerusalem, and I did finally get to our subject of the morning, when we did get to the holiness, when we do get to the holiness of Jerusalem, we see battled out over Jerusalem what is to be the meaning of holiness among our people. Jerusalem begins its history in a rather undistinguished way. It appears as a town early in the second millennium before the Common Era, a Canaanite town ruled apparently by priests, kings, theocrats, who spoke one of the Canaanite tongues, whose last name tended to include the word Tzedek. Melchizedek of Abraham's time is the king of Jerusalem, except that Jerusalem in those days was called Shalom, or Shalem, Salem. How did it become Jerusalem? Simply enough. The word was Urusalem in late second millennium terms. Ur, well, it means cornerstone. It came ultimately to be the same as the Hebrew word ear. The city, Yerushalayim, means the city of Shalem. And contrary to all of those pious homilies that you've heard over the years, Shalem does not come from the same root as Shalom. Jerusalem does not mean the city of peace. Unfortunately, it has rarely been the city of peace. It means the city of Shalemu, the city of Shalem, who was one of the early Canaanite gods. That's all the word means, Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem seems to have escaped the conquest of the Israelites longer than any other of the major towns in Judean hills. We don't know quite why. But it wasn't until around the year 993 before the Common Era, about 250 years after the beginning of the conquest, that David finally was able to capture Jerusalem. And at that point in 993 before the Common Era, he moved his capital from Hebron a few miles north to the city we now know, we now think of as the capital of the Jewish state. It was a small town, and it had, as all these Canaanite towns had, a high place, the threshing floor of Aruna, which David purchased from its owner. And some years later, his son Solomon built on this high place a royal shrine. And it became one of the shrines that the Israelites had during the 10th, 9th, and 8th centuries B.C. It was not the single shrine. It was not the most holy place for many, many centuries. The great places were Shiloh, Bethel. Jerusalem owes its very special position, not only to the fact that it became and remained the capital, but to one of the great early tragedies of Jewish life, and to a miracle which seemed to take place there. In the 8th century before the Common Era, a great power arose between the Tigris and Euphrates River in what is now Iraq, known as the Assyrian Empire. Its capital was Nineveh. It was the mightiest empire of the age. And the emperors of Assyria determined, after they had subdued the lands around them, to move westward, to move across Syria and Lebanon to the Mediterranean so they could have trade, first of all, with the Mediterranean communities. And then their ultimate aim was to move south across Israel and conquer Egypt and to be able to absorb and control the great wealth of Egypt. And so during the 730s and the 720s, they destroyed one by one the small kingdoms of Syria, of Lebanon, including the largest of the Hebrew kingdoms, the northern kingdom of Israel. Israel, Samaria, was captured in 722 before the Common Era. These tribes, the 10 tribes that comprised Israel, were taken to the east as exiled, and they pass into history as the famous lost 10 tribes. Judea, Jerusalem, which is really nothing more than a city-state, survived. In 701, 15 years later, the Assyrians decided that before they could move directly against Egypt, they ought to have a mop-up operation and take the very few small, out-of-the-way cities which were behind their front lines so they couldn't be endangered from the rear. Jerusalem was one of them. And in 701, the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, came to Jerusalem and besieged Hezekiah, the king, in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem had no chance. But then a strange thing happened. Isaiah the prophet, who had in the preceding years been bringing the word of God, judgment against Judea. He had spoken to the people of their sins. He had spoken to the people that of the fact that this attack would come because they had failed the covenant. It was deserved. Who had spoken to them of the dangers that they would face, suddenly spoke a word in the name of God that no one expected from him. V'ganoti al ha'ir hazel hoshia. I, God, will be a shield around this city to deliver it. And no sooner had Isaiah spoken these words than, for reasons that no one quite understands, Sennacherib lifted the siege of Jerusalem and his main army retreated to the east. Now, the Bible explains this miracle by saying that the angel of God had appeared at night in the Assyrian camp and had destroyed 185,000 men, which suggests plague. Archaeologists have found one of the great monumental record stelae that Sennacherib raised, in which he said that Hezekiah paid him great ransom and tribute in order to lift the siege. We don't really know what happened. Modern historians tend to believe that some message summoned Sennacherib back east to his capital, something to do with the rise of the power of the Babylonians and the Medes to his east, a much stronger power than anything that the Judeans represented, and a power which would ultimately overthrow the Assyrians. Whatever the reason, Jerusalem was relieved, spared. It was a holy city. God had protected his city. Particularly, he had protected his temple, a temple which since 722 at least had been the only surviving shrine. And now it becomes the only holy shrine, the only place where Jews would ever think to come to worship. And this edifice complex, this concern with building, this concern with holy objects, becomes a main preoccupation of our fathers during the subsequent century. 110 years later, the Babylonians are in their turn ready to move east, to move towards the Mediterranean, to move down and to conquer Egypt. And now they waste no time in coming up against Jerusalem. And there is a new prophet in these days, Jeremiah. And Jeremiah has been saying much the same thing that Isaiah had said 100 years before. This tragedy has come to you because you failed, because you did that was unjust and unrighteous. You deserve your fate. And Jeremiah never said that God would spare the city. Rather, he said the city would be destroyed. And in one of the most powerful of the sermons which he gives, he attacks directly this illusion. He uses the word, this illusion that there are places which are so holy that like a piece of radium, you cannot pick them up without being destroyed, which are so holy that no enemy can, in fact, pick them up and take them away. They say, Jeremiah said, the Lord of hosts has said, mend your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. He goes on, do not put your trust in illusions and say, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these buildings. They are inviolate. They will be destroyed. And they were destroyed. Holiness as an attribute, holiness as a concept, is one which our tradition has always tried to fill with some kind of ethical content. The Bible describes holiness in the book of Leviticus. In that famous chapter which we read on the holiest day of our year, on Yom Kippur. Holiness is the adjective which we relate to God. And the chapter begins, "Holy shall ye be, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Kadoshim to you, ki kadosh ani Adonai Elohecha." In what does holiness consist? Holiness consists in rendering just decision. Holiness consists in removing the stumbling block from in front of the blind. Holiness consists in leaving the gleanings of your field for the poor. Holiness consists in just weights and just measures. Holiness consists in loving your neighbor as you would love yourself. Not once in all this chapter is holiness related to that which most people tend to relate holiness to. The man who lives a monastic life, who flagellates, who maintains long vigils, who adopts a life of celibacy, who withdraws from the world, who fasts endlessly. The kind of association which, to a large degree, made, let's say, for the authority which the Mahatma, the great soul Gandhi, earned for himself. Not once is holiness described in that way. Holiness has to do with righteous living and all the terms which we ordinarily associate with that word. But theologians can write and can preach and can teach, and mankind has never for a moment abandoned its illusions, its sense that there are holy objects, that there are things that we can wear around our neck which protect us from dangers, that there are images we can put on the ledge of our cars which will protect us from accidents, that there are magical holy acts which we can perform which will somehow see to it that ill does not befall us, which only proves that we are fallible and mortal and anxious, and that in fact there are times when the miraculous seems to occur, and we would not like to have every chance for that to happen to us. Now, the holiness of Jerusalem was assured by that original miracle. It was assured by the presence of the temple. It was assured by the fact that the temple was rebuilt, and that when it was rebuilt, people brought there their needs and their fears and their hopes, and sometimes, as with prayers and illnesses, their needs and their hopes were answered. Holy acts were performed there to which people ascribed holy significance. And ultimately, if you are willing to suspend disbelief, things do happen that would not have happened otherwise. Now, the major holiness of Jerusalem lies in several areas, which we again know normally as modern Jews associate with Judaism. The first has to do with the coming of the Messiah. When you're in Jerusalem, they'll point out to you on Mount Zion, a church, the Church of the Remission. Behind it, they'll tell you, lies the tomb of King David. Now, the tomb of King David is nothing more or less than a 12th century cave which workers were building a church above the place where the Last Supper was supposed to have taken place, happened to stumble upon when they were trying to put some foundations down, and as suddenly as most things in Jerusalem became like the rock of destruction, a holy place. The tomb of King David, as the Talmud already admits, its location is not known. But it was believed to be sealed near Jerusalem, because the dead were not buried within the city walls. And that in the Messianic age, that tomb would become unsealed, and David would emerge and again become the king in Israel. I told the children this morning one of the wonderful legends which comes from our past, which has to do with this sense of the holiness of the tomb. Two yeshiva bochers in Europe, in the Middle Ages, spent their days and their nights studying, pondering holy writ. hoping that they would find the secret, the date, the time of the coming of the Messiah, praying that Israel's sufferings might be over. And such was their piety, and such was their fervor and their zeal, that Elijah finally took pity on them and took pity on Israel, and he came to them. He said to them, I will tell you the secret of the Messiah, but you must do exactly as I tell you. Here is a cruse of oil. It is sealed. Take it with you to Jerusalem and go up a certain mountain to a certain rock. And before that rock, repeat this formula, and he gives him a magical formula, and the rock will open. And inside the rock, you will find the throne, the golden throne of King David. You will find the harp that King David used when he sang the Psalms. But you must not be distracted by these or the wealth that you will see. You must go down into the cave, and there you will see a bier. King David is in the sleep of death on top of the bier. His hands are folded. And when you come before the bier, you must recite exactly this second formula. And David will begin to move and to stir and to rise, and his hands will unfold. And then you must take this cruse of oil and pour it into his right hand. He will be reanointed, and he will come to life, and Israel's travail will be over. And these two young men took the cruse of oil, and they began the long, long journey to Jerusalem. And they came to Jerusalem, and they found the rock. And with fear and trepidation, they recited the formula exactly as Elijah had given it to them. And the rock opened. And there before their eyes was a golden throne of David, and there was the golden harp of David. But they managed to concentrate on their mission. And they went down into the cave, and there was the bier, and there was David in the sleep of death on the bier. And they concentrated, and they recited exactly the second formula. And David began to sit up and to open up his arms. And they were so overwhelmed by what they saw that they took the cruse of oil and they poured it out, as they'd been told, but on his left hand and not on his right hand. And the hands folded. And David went back to sleep. And we're still awaiting the coming of the Messiah. Jerusalem is a city where the Messiah will come. And because of that, it is the city where resurrection will take place. You've been to Jerusalem, and you know, particularly now that the city is united, if you go to the east side of the city, you see the Mount of Olives. And on the Mount of Olives, you know, it's one giant graveyard. Why is this graveyard on the Mount of Olives? Well, because Jews are never ones who are patient at the back of the line. The Mount of Olives is the place where resurrection will begin. Why will it begin there? It will begin there because of the 14th chapter of the book of Zechariah. Zechariah was a prophet who lived at the time of the return from the Babylonian exile. And he has a great apocalypse, which ends his book, in which he imagines the last days. And it reads this way. On that day, the day of judgment, God will set his feet on the Mount of Olives near Jerusalem to the east. And the Mount of Olives shall split across from east to west. On that day, living water shall come forth from Jerusalem, and the Lord shall be king in all of the earth. The mountains will split, graves will come to the surface, the living waters will come forth, and the resurrection will take place here. If you go to Jerusalem, you know that on the east side, there is a double gate called the Golden Gate, or the Shaar HaRachamim, the Gate of Mercy, which is closed and has been closed for millennia. Supposedly, when the temple was destroyed, That's the way the divine presence left the temple to the east. And when the divine presence will return, that's the way it will return, and the gate will open up automatically, magically, as Jerusalem moves into its full glory. And obviously, if the Shekhinah, God's presence, has come to the east, the Mount of Olives is the next thing eastward from the Golden Gate. That's where the Messiah will first touch down, and those are the first people who will enjoy the resurrection. Now, that's a powerful image. It was so powerful that throughout the Middle Ages, one of the major goods which the shlichim, whom I told you about a few weeks ago, the men who went out from Jerusalem to get money from the diaspora to maintain the prayers of the mourners of Zion in Jerusalem, one of the major goods that they carried with them were bags of dust gathered in the on the Mount of Olives. And throughout Europe, I suppose here even too in America, many pious Jews were buried with little bags of earth from the Mount of Olives. Somehow being buried with that dust reassured them that they too would be in the dust of the Mount of Olives at the time of resurrection. And I can still remember when one of the older members of the temple who was born in the Ukraine came to me and told me how as a child, his father had taken him to the hillside near their little town and shown him some caves and told him that these were the caves through which the bodies of Jews would begin to tumble down, roll down to Jerusalem when the Messiah would come and the time of resurrection would take place. So since, for the last 2,000 years at least, Jerusalem has been associated with the holiness of immortality, of resurrection. The Arabs who share this belief, and the Arabs made sure that their cemetery in the Mount of Olives is up closer to the Eastern Gate than that of the Jews, called Jerusalem Al-Quds, Ir HaKodesh, the holy city. And many of their legends echo the legends of the Jews. Well, there's a legend that deals with the east side of Jerusalem, and there's a legend which deals with the west side of Jerusalem, the so-called Western Wall, the Kotel HaMaravi, what used to be called the Wailing Wall, which is a bad translation because it's really what they really mean is what the French say when they say le mur des pleurs, the mountain, the wall where people cry, the wall where wailing takes place, the mourning for Jerusalem. Now, despite all you have heard, the custom of coming to prayer at the Western Wall is a relatively recent one. It is no earlier than the 16th century. It's only in the 16th century when the Turks reconquered Jerusalem, the late 15th, early 16th, and began to clean the city up. The debris was taken away from the wall, and access was made possible to the wall, and that this whole process could have been considered in the first place. But it quickly became one of the great holy places of our people, even though during most of Turkish times we were only allowed through some alleys to come to a piece of the wall which was about 60 feet long, and the alley before the wall was no more than 12 or 14 yards wide, and we were not allowed to bring in any chairs or desks or holy objects. The Turks, the Muslims, made sure that what we were able to do there was very limited. But it became a holy place. Why? It was associated with the fact of the restoration of Jerusalem. It became the wall that the Romans could not destroy. Legends developed that when Rome had conquered Jerusalem in the year 70 and had determined to pull down the walls of the temple, the legionaries had been able to pull down every wall but this one. This wall had resisted on its own, and therefore it had been left. And it was proof that God still was in his city, still protected his temple, and of course would in time rebuild his shrine. Now, actually, the Romans left the way the Western Wall, I'm sure, for a very practical reason. The wall itself has nothing to do with the buildings of the temple. It is simply an extension wall, a retaining wall that was built by Herod, we believe, in order to enlarge the plaza at the top so that the fill which he was using to enlarge the plaza to the east and to the south would not flow down into the Trypanean Valley, would be held in place, and the plaza on top should be enlarged. And the Romans, I suppose, who wanted to reuse Jerusalem as a major city, didn't want all of this muck, all of this debris to come down on places, on streets and markets and places where they lived. But whatever the original practical reason, the medieval legend had it that God had protected this wall, that it was a symbol of his continuing concern. He had not abandoned Jerusalem. Indeed, he waited behind the wall, and if you offered your prayers there, he was there, and your prayers would be heard. And the reason I read to you from the Song of Songs this morning is that the text that I read to you is the text which bespoke the certainty that God heard your prayers there, that God was waiting behind the wall for Israel's repentance for the time when he could send the Messiah. Awake, my beloved. There he comes, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. There he stands behind the wall. My beloved spoke, and he said, my fair one, come away, for though the winter is past, the rains are over and gone, and the blossoms are again abroad in the land. It was a great association of God's presence and of that place. Now, it was also a difficult one. If you read the history of Jerusalem during the 1920s, and during the 1910s and earlier, you'll find that the Jewish community and the Arab community fought over the right of Jews to come through this alley to the wall. If a Jew happened to bring a chair into that area to sit for his prayers, it could be an international incident before the day was over. There were at least a dozen international commissions brought into being in the first 30 years of this century to try and deal with the issue of the Jews and the Western Wall. Great diplomats from neutral countries, Sweden, France, the United States, met solemnly for days on end to try and decide whether the Jews could or could not bring a safer Torah to the wall on Yom Kippur, whether they were allowed to touch the wall, which was agreed by all was Arab property, or whether they could simply, by ancient right, come to the courtyard in front of the wall. Whatever was to be decided by these international bodies, the Jews continued to come. It was certainly the holy place. They would bring with them very often little parchments on which they had written their prayers, and they would place the prayers in the wall itself, in one of the crevices of the wall, that God, I suppose, behind the wall might snatch the prayer in and read it, and make sure that that prayer was answered. But it spoke of the Messiah, it spoke of the rebuilding of Jerusalem. I suppose it spoke of all the themes that have made that the wall so precious to Jews in our day. And the wall continues to exert this power, this holiness in our day. For more than any other reason I know, it is the wall which will prevent city of Jerusalem ever to be divided again. The Jews will never allow the wall to be closed to them or to be under anyone else's authority. It speaks of the past, and more importantly, it speaks of the future. It speaks of all the immemorial hopes of the Jewish nation. And it speaks to the secular Jew in one way, to the religious Jew in another, but to all Jews, it has a message. There was a holiness to the east of Jerusalem, there was a holiness to the west of Jerusalem, and there was a holiness above Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the only city in the world which has its heavenly counterpart. There's Yerushalayim Shel Mata, the city we know, Jerusalem which is below, and Yerushalayim Shel Mala, the Jerusalem which is in heaven, which is the very, very model of what a great city must be. And one of the interesting facts about our tradition and how it handled holiness is that as long as Jerusalem was in Jewish hands, they tried to set up a series of rules for Jerusalem which would in fact make it a model city. The Talmud contains many of these rules. They're interesting. Garbage was to be collected in Jerusalem every day. Ancient cities had great dung heaps, and they were the places where vermin and insects, you know, multiplied. There were to be no dung heaps in Jerusalem. The city was to be clean. Jerusalem was to have no smokestack industry. There's a specific law in the Talmud which says there are to be no kilns in Jerusalem, no furnaces, nothing that makes smokes, nothing that could dirty the city, pollute the air. Corpses were not allowed to remain in Jerusalem overnight. The streets of Jerusalem were not to have balconies built out over them, that the sun could come down on everyone, and that people would not, as they did in the ancient world, simply pitch their dirty water and their garbage out into the streets. There were to be no orchards, no gardens, and no chicken coops in Jerusalem. Strange rule, it seems, at first sight, but when we remember that fertilizer was dung, it was an attempt to keep Jerusalem a clean city. And the chickens are, of course, noisy. Noise pollution is also a form of pollution. In every way fit for that much more primitive age, Jerusalem was to be protected from all the blight which we associate with any urban metropolis. And one of the great beauties of Jerusalem used to be the fact that Jerusalem was a city of beauty, and for a city in that part of the world, a fairly clean city. As it has grown and grown to for out of Jerusalem, Zion shall come forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. By example, we were to show mankind how one could live in an urban environment. I wish we could. I wish we knew ourselves. It's certainly one of the lessons which awaits man's discovery. But the sense of the closeness of the heavenly Jerusalem, the sense of the model for which is the pattern for what is below, meant also that it was the place where God was the closest. Jerusalem, when you go to Israel, you make aliyah, you go up. When you go to Jerusalem, you sing the Shir HaMa'alot, the pilgrim songs of going up. Jerusalem is at the top of the mountains. It is the highest place, the nearest to heaven, the place, therefore, where prayers are most likely to be heard. And so my closing legend comes from the Bible. When Jacob, our father, fled from his home and was out alone in the wilderness, having defrauded Esau of his birthright, you recall that first night he lies down in the open air, he takes a stone as his pillow, and he has a vision of a great ladder, Selamutzavatsa, a great ladder which reaches from heaven to earth. And up on that ladder, angels of God are ascending and descending. When he rises, he says, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." Well, according to Jewish tradition, this rock which Jacob used for his pillar is the cornerstone of the city of Jerusalem. It is the place where the ladder exists between heaven and earth, where angels descend, and where the prayers of men have the least distance to travel to heaven to be heard. It's the holiest of the holy cities. And as always, when we deal with holiness, we deal with emotion and religious fervor. And therefore, the settlement of Jerusalem, the political settlement of Jerusalem, cannot, despite what diplomats feel, be handled in reasonable terms. You cannot deal with what Jerusalem means to Jews and to Christians and to Muslims in their own way by arguing reasonably who should give up once. It is to Jews the city of God. It is to Muslim Al-Quds, the holy place, It is to Christianity the place where Jesus walked, the place of Gethsemane, the Holy Sepulchre. It is not a city which politicians will be able to arrange rational, reasonable arrangements for. What that means for our future, for the future of the Middle East, it's hard to tell. But it certainly means that Jerusalem must remain united. And given the 2,000 years of history which I have not told you, 2,000 years in which first Christians and then Muslims and then Christians again and then Muslims again locked Jews away from everything that was sacred to them in Jerusalem. It is not a city which now the Jews control it, they are likely to give back to other folk. When Jews controlled Jerusalem, non-Jews were welcomed there. When Jews have controlled Jerusalem in the last 20 years, the shrines of Muslims and Christians have been inviolate. Somehow we're the only people who can be trusted with the faith of those who believe other than we do. And that is too one of the considerations which a Jew knows deep in his heart and the world has yet to learn. Amen.